Josh and Laser.
Parts of wonder and amazement. What you call it? Culture Laser.
Welcome to Culture Laser, everybody. We're very, very excited to be in Berlin. Thank you all for showing up. Tonight on the show, we've got Imogen Heath, the co-founder of Now Moment Now, a great film project, as well as being a filmmaker in her own right. She's going to be sharing some of her films and talking about them. And of course, we've got Sticky Biscuits playing wonderful songs for us live and in person, which is great. And we've got Sholem Krystalka. Very sorry. For people who don't know your illustrations and what you've been doing here in Berlin, could you just tell us a little bit about the project that you've embarked on?
The project that I've been doing is keeping visual narrative diary of my time here. And it's called A Berlin Diary. It is exactly what it sounds like. It's a chronicle of my time here in Berlin. It's an ongoing diary that's in the form of, it's structured like a silent film. So instead of like thought balloons and dialogue balloons, it's just sort of subtitles.
And there's a lot of really beautiful, just quite quiet, empty panels as well.
Yes, there are. I try and keep the text very, very spare.
What was the impetus for doing this?
First and foremost, it's sort of the way that, like, generally my work had been tending for a long time. In my drawing and painting practice, I'm generally interested in documenting myself and my life and sort of my community, and there are a whole other sort of a bunch of other things that kind of get built into that. So there was one reason, was that like I was working towards that anyway. The second reason was that when I first moved here, I think like almost everybody that moves here, I didn't know how long I would be here for. And at the very least, I wanted to have a record of my time and a record that I had made. One of the sort of overarching preoccupations of my practice is the difference between what it means actually to make a drawing. Between Facebook and Instagram and then this sort of this whole culture of sort of image devouring, I think people sort of consume images faster and faster and faster. And now the speed with which people consume images is now basically the speed of your Facebook feed. And, you know, photographs happen in a fraction of a second. And I'm really interested in what it means to actually build an image, to make an image by hand, sort of gesture by gesture and stroke by stroke.
It's really interesting that you say that, because actually when I was reading it, I was surprised at how much time I took to, like, just with the actual images and how slow the reading was. It's a different way of looking at something.
One of the things that's important to me, but it's like likely important to no one else, is that process of consuming an image and creating an image gets slowed down, and playing with time, and I try and play with pacing a little bit. I have this sort of perpetual worry, because it exists online. The archive of the complete diary is on Tumblr, and it also got picked up by Random House Canada. They have an online blog, and that's at hazletmag.com. And so one of the worries that I have when it gets translated into an online format is that I lose control over the pacing of the images, like how much space is between the images, because, you know, I'm trained as a painter and a drawer, so I'm sort of acutely aware of like installation concerns and things like that, and how much space to put between images, and what happens when you sort of crowd images together, what happens when you disperse them. And so I lose control over that when it gets translated into an online format.
They're just, for people who haven't seen it, they're just a static box, so you go through one panel at a time, opposed to having the full page layout. Is it hard to go into the autobiographical mode, or have you been doing it for long enough that you find it quite easy? Do you find yourself mining your own life for incidents? You talk about some quite personal stuff, going for an STD or STI test, your breakup, these kind of things. That's a lot of personal stuff that involves other people who are part of your life. Is that difficult for you to translate? Do you obscure stuff ever? Do you find it a challenge, or do you just put it out of your mind?
Yeah, it's never easy. And truth be told, I mean, I know only to a limited extent exactly what I'm doing. Like, I know in a formal sense what I'm doing, and I know in a narrative sense what I'm doing. Making this project, it's the first time I've ever sort of done something like this. And making this project very much still feels to me, even like a year on. It very much still feels to me like groping in the dark. I am mindful of the participation of other people in my project, the unwilling participation, for the most part, of other people in my project. But on the other hand, I myself was the subject of a character in a book. I know what that feels like. I know what the process is.
That's such a weird thing. How did you feel about that, being showing up in somebody else's work?
It was really strange. My former upstairs neighbor in Toronto, where I lived for 10 years before moving here, is a famous Canadian novelist. Her name is Sheila Hetty, and her latest book is called How Should a Person Be, and I'm one of the characters in it. And when it got released in the States, it sort of went really huge, and there was this really strange, you know, I'd read multiple versions of the book, and there was a strange moment where all of a sudden I had to read reviews that referred to me as if I was a person that did not exist in the world. And, you know, like, for the purposes of her book, you know, Sheila has me do things and sort of edits what I say to sort of suit her own needs. And so I'm kind of keenly aware of what it is to be used for someone else's ends. And in the end, that's like, it actually, this way of working is very much, I think I very much inherited it from Toronto. It's very much like how people work in Toronto. You kind of have nothing, so you use what's around you.
But there's also all those great comic book artists who've done that for a very long time now, I guess 15, 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not actually, I have to admit that I'm really not so much of a comics aficionado. And I don't approach the diary as a comic book.
Something interesting about what I was thinking today when I was reading it was you have a whole series on finding an apartment here in Berlin.
Yeah.
And I've never looked for an apartment in Berlin, but I already hate it. It's a terribly dehumanizing and soulless process. And I was just thinking just about the general tone and look of your drawings and the comic. Feels like there's a sadness there, or a grayness maybe, that comes out just from the way the style of drawing. And I wonder how that affects your interaction with the city itself. And if, when you sit down to write, you know, like whenever I write a letter, say,
right,
I always write a really maudlin letter, even if I'm feeling quite good.
Yeah.
Because just the process of sitting down to write a letter just somehow makes me want to write sad crap.
Again, one of the like overarching preoccupations of my work is the idea of like a transference of emotion. What happens to me when I have to relive memories, and not just relive, but reconstruct and therefore re-embody these memories? And so I'm really interested in the transference of emotion that happens, like visually, like can I somehow project that re-experiencing into my work? And the other thing is, like, there's a sadness to it, I think, because of the content of the diary itself. There is a tragedy that kind of like hugs the diary, and that sort of sits just outside it and kind of like haunts the periphery of it. Just as it inflects me, it inflects the diary. So like the current episode, I guess, the process of my finding the apartment that I'm actually living in now was like really long and really arduous. And I knew as I was going through it that I would put it in the diary. But I knew it was also too long to be like one full installment, and I knew I had to break it up. And there was this encounter with this guy that I had met at Berghain, and we sort of, speaking of maudlin, we had this really weird Richard Linklater movie-esque sort of like missed encounters. And I decided to use that. I mean, first of all, chronologically, it's correct. It occurred like while I was looking for an apartment. But the reason I put it in there was because it seemed a good way to demonstrate accumulations of stress.
Did you think this was going to work? I mean, this is something that I think is an interesting thing, just as a model for doing things. You started putting up this diary online free, paradoxically, because the internet changes the way we look at things, but at the same time, it's free and you can make it accessible to people who would want to see it.
Yeah.
Were you surprised that it got taken up by Random House? Did you think anybody would be into it? Did you want people to see it, or were you archiving? Because it feels very so personal that it's almost like sometimes I feel like I shouldn't necessarily be reading it.
Obviously, you know, all artists want people to see their work. But I'm not doing this for anybody. My intention of like having a document of my time here that I built is still very much the intention of the project. So I'm really just doing it for me. I had a really kind of funny exchange with my mother after the STI test episode. One of the things that's included is they give you a free counseling session before you have your test, and so you sort of admit to all the tawdry things you've done. And I really kind of felt it personally important to include the fact that I had had very risky, unprotected sex. It's one of the themes of that particular installment. And my mom sent me an email saying, like, you can't do that again. And we had this really charming, like really sweet back and forth where, you know, it's just like, you know, I know that like I'm like a single person now for the first time in a while and you have to deal with this reality of my life. It was like, for personal reasons, it was very important for me to do. And her answer was she thought that I meant that it was very important for me to do in this sort of like public service announcement kind of a way. Like she wrote back, like, I know you need to do this in her own like beautiful, unique phrasing. I know you need to do this for your gaze. And I thought that was really sweet. And I was just like, no, I didn't do it for anybody else. Like I did not publicly admit to having like very risky, unprotected anal sex, just like, as a public service announcement. Like it was important for me to document that admission, to document the memory of that admission, to like this whole sort of chain of memory and re-experiencing.
What do you think the importance to you of speaking the truth to yourself, I guess, comes from?
I don't know. I've always kind of, like in my own work, I'm really kind of intent on honesty, and I'm really intent on sort of a search for a kind of an emotional truth. And it's something that I've sort of really felt the importance of, having kind of emerged battle scarred from graduate school, where the importance of theory above all else is taught to you, and the importance of your work being justified via a series of abstract concepts is justified to you. And I fully believe that, and like I really do think that like intelligent work should be self-aware. I think it's even more important for an artist to be personally involved in his own work. Like all of the work that I find exciting to look at, to read, to consume, involves a personal investment on the part of the artist. And by contrast, all the work that I find really boring and useless is work where that personal investment is like buried under like geologic layers of theory.
Well, I'm really pleased you make the work, man. It's beautiful. And if people haven't had a chance to look at it, they should. And it's really easy.
The whole archive of the diary is at aberlindiary.tumblr.com.
Thank you so much. Can we get a big round of
thank
applause?
You.
Thank you. Golan Krystalka, thank you.
Is an excerpt from a film called Love Butter Love. It's an installation, really. It just came from, I was thinking, it's about fetish and how fetish is created, or I was kind of thinking about how fetish is born. I was thinking a lot about a memory of my own where a babysitter had told me that if I rubbed butter onto my boobs, they would grow bigger. It's basically a 3-screen video work that I have mainly shown in film screenings, but I originally intended it to be like seen across 3 screens in a space. On the first screen that comes up is basically a shot of my boobs, and then the screen on the left is my face, and then the third screen is a image of me turning cream into butter.
Is this something? Is this a true story?
Yeah, it's a true story. I mean, I actually don't. My fetish is not that I want bigger boobs, but I'm just interested in like memory and how memories become fetishized. And I very much fetishize this memory. And then I'm just, my work is very much related to memory and history. Yeah, the image of like making or churning butter, I think like there's an element of that that's like the butter is maybe like what is created and what is like left over, or I guess what we choose to remember. And then the like milk that comes out from like the cream is like thrown away. And I, yeah, that is a, maybe a metaphor for the things we choose to forget.
Because when I saw this and read about it a little bit, I thought of this friend of mine who's into bondage, and he told me this story once a while back where he was like, yeah, when I was a kid, my babysitter tied me up and like rubbed against me, and I got this amazing hard-on. It was like the first time I'd ever had a hard-on, and now he's just got this, you know, great...
babysitter fetish.
No, he likes to be tied up. That's what he traces it back to, and that idea that a fetish can be created blew my mind. That these things that happen to you can then create a long lasting effect.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that like we also always need to try to find a cause for something or like blame something for things.
And in terms of just doing this video, why was it important to put? To have the triptych kind of aspect to it. That's another thing I was wondering about.
I'm kind of interested in how we like perceive images in a 3D space, and then how that also influences like what you take and what you leave behind also. Like, so maybe you're not always, like if you can't actually watch every screen at once, you're only taking in so much information, but that's kind of also like everyday life also.
Yeah, you have to make decisions about what means something to you and where to look.
Yeah, I guess I'm also interested in how this happens, like on a grander scale of like how countries create histories also, how that like evolves. Yeah, I think like my work is very much about like experimenting with narrative and like, and how narrative can play out over multiple screens.
Can you tell us a little bit about Now Moment Now, the project, please?
So Now Moment Now is a film collective, which I started with a good friend and collaborator, Sam Ickler. We have very different aesthetics, and I think it was a good way for us to kind of like combine those aesthetics and create work together and encourage one another to create work and put it out there. But then it's very much, it's like evolved a lot since we first started. We make films together, and it's like moving image work, experimental narrative stuff. We do weird things all the time.
And Sam was the person who you wrote like kind of a visual letter to, right? That is that because the footage, if I remember correctly, was kind of old Super 8 kind of stuff, no?
Yeah, it was a mixture of found footage and 16mm that I had shot. And then some VHS stuff of like Sam's like family home movie footage. Yeah, I mean, I primarily work on film. Sam usually works on digital, so I think that was also like an interesting way for us to like meet one another and work together. And then that work, which is called Letters 2-6. It was a moment when we were both away from one another, but we were also kind of in dialogue a lot about being in Berlin and away from home. So like these kind of two like disconnected moments and trying to find a way to like talk to one another about that.
But you talk a little bit about like the idea of the moment and the importance of the moment, which I guess is kind of different than this sort of overarching narrative of histories, right? Do you find yourself paying attention more to moments having created this project?
It is Now Moment Now is basically just a platform to try to deal with some of these contradictions, I guess, and explore time in a queer way, I guess.
Thank you so much, everybody. Pleasure. Check out nowmomentnow.com.
Thank you.
Thank you. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Rosie, color, country, lights, sir!
So our next guests, our next and final guests are not so much a band as a movement, a revolution, a way of life, if you will. They're our friends, Mark and Naomi, otherwise known as Sticky Biscuits.
Well, it took us forever to find a band name. We had so many. It was Sticky Melons, and then it was...
Sticky Buns.
Sticky Buns.
Why did we come to Sticky?
Wait, you tried to figure out that you named your band in one... Sticky morning.
No, it actually took over 2 months and a newspaper contest and getting on our friends' nerves a lot.
We needed to, it took bribing people to actually come up with ideas.
Wait, what do you mean? You crowdsourced your name?
Yeah, I do a comic strip in a newspaper, and we went so far as to make it a contest in the newspaper so people would send us suggestions.
What could they have won?
They all won a drawing, actually. I had to do 12 drawings this week.
Wait, why? Because...
Because Naomi's also an illustrator and comic author.
And everybody who submitted an entry?
Well, basically, we said that the one who won was going to get one, but we didn't pick any one of the ones they sent in. And so I felt so bad. I was like, okay, everybody's getting a drawing.
So they all got a consolation prize, yeah.
And you only had 12? You only had 12.
There was one that was so cute.
The Reckhölderle?
Reckhölderle. Which is, I'm from the south of Germany, which is Swabia, which is not a very popular group of the Berlin population. And
there's kill the Swabes graffitis in Prenzlauer Berg.
Yeah, Swabians go home.
Why, really?
Yeah.
We're the hillbillies of Germany.
Oh. So what was the name?
The rich hillbillies of Germany.
Well, yes. And the Reckhölderle, and this guy, he very nice writing, and he wrote, well... 100 years ago, the young men of the south of Germany would go into the meadows and pick this flower, the Reckhölderle or Heideröslein, which is the meadow rose, and they would put a sprig into their hats, and then they would go forth and sing about their lands. And since we're a band and we sing about some land, and so he said we should be called that. And that was so adorable, so he's getting the prettiest drawing.
I like the story so much, I almost wanted to change the band name for this.
I know, well, we'll do t-shirts. We could name the album that, I think.
Oh, that'd hey, good idea. You have your next 12 albums ready to go now. Speaking of albums, you're doing a little bit of crowdfunding for your album. This is why you're a movement, I think. You're a crowd-based band.
Yeah.
Tell us about the album that you're trying to get funded.
Shall we do like a song first so people actually know what we're talking about?
All right, a big round of applause for Sticky Biscuits, please.
Okay, so this is a song. I mean, it's the hottest day of the year so far. We wrote a song because we're in Berlin, and you know, on the hottest day of the year, like, maybe I would like a relationship. But then you're like, nowadays in Berlin, what could that look like? It can have so many shapes and forms. And some of us are so lost that we turn to religion. There's a man. He's a good man. He's got great sense of humor, and he's really good with kids. There's another man. He's a good man too. He's not so good with kids, but the sex is really great. They both would like to have me as their wife, but they both want to be the only person in my life. I don't know how I could choose just one, if that would mean that I would lose the other one. Oh, I wish I was a Southern Mormon bigamist. Not one, not two, but three names on my wedding registry list. I wish I was a Southern bigamist Mormon. Turn around and see two loving faces in the morning. There's a woman. She's a good woman. She likes to cook and listen, and she always understands. There's another woman. She's a hot woman. She's wild and crazy, and she does amazing things with her hands. I asked them both if they would be my steady. They looked at me and said, kid, you're not ready. And I guess that from their point of view, they're right. 'Cause I'd really like to have them over together for the night. Oh, I wish I was a Southern Mormon bigamist. But that'd be tricky because I am an atheist. I go for polygamist Polynesian or polyandrous Nepalesian. Some people say to me that I am greedy. I'm selfish, narcissistic, and I'm needy. But I don't think I'm a whore just cause I want more. Cause if there's one thing better than two breasts in your face, well then it's whore. Work. It can make you go berserk, but it can work, I hope. And hey, it'll piss off the Pope. So I guess I'll be a Berlin polyamorist, a multiple people cuddling anarchist. And if you would like to be one too, give us a call and we'll see what we can do.
I've written a very sad song, and it's about, I don't know if it's that way in Edinburgh or in other countries, but here in Germany, I have been on the Autobahn, and I made this discovery, and once you are on the Autobahn on Germany, or anywhere in Germany, frankly, you'll see this too. Anyway, here goes. Can you guys hear this? Okay.
Driving on the Autobahn, you always see a big motor bus filled with old people to the last seat looking out at us. And as I look back up into each wrinkled face, I wonder what is up, why it's always the case that no matter what their favorite color is, and I don't mean to be mean, at some point they throw out all the orange and blues and wear nothing but camel and cream. Dear old people, why beige? When you reach a certain age, why beige? There's so many other colors. Rest stop, the bus stopped as well. I saw the driver and I asked him, do tell, why is it all the rage for old people to wear nothing but beige? And he said it's to let the angel of death know that they're ready to go. He said, I am one of the drivers of death, and when old folks are ready to breathe their last breath, they get out the cocky and tan. And every beige woman and man gets picked up by the bus and they drive wherever you go and you're no longer alive. And that's why I'll always wear black. I was born and I'll never go back. I'll never wear beige and you can't make me. And if I don't, you can't take me. But one day we'll be the ones who are left, cause all our friends have gone. And then you and I will put all our dark clothes aside, and you will hand me a sweater the color of sand, and we'll wait by the side of the road. And when the bus comes, it will stop. I'll kiss you and help you get up. and we'll get to our feet. We'll get on and we'll take a seat, and then we'll say goodbye. And with a sigh, the bus starts up and rides to where the road meets the sky.
So tell us about this great and exciting crowdfunding campaign, because I bet a lot of people now want to hear a full album. Where can we get your album, actually?
It's not done yet, but we're recording right now. We thought this would just like take like a weekend or two, but obviously when you sit down to record this stuff, you have lots of ideas, and we're like in this home studio with a guy who really knows his craft and who's had lots of ideas. And
it's called Behind the Couch Studios. Look it up.
Yeah, and so now this has been going on for 2 months now.
I think so.
Yeah, so we thought, Jesus, like we should pay him like a little bit more, actually, like he asked us. So we thought let's make it like a small crowdfunding thing, not only to pay the studio guy the money he deserves for putting much more effort into it than we thought we would need, but also to make some videos for it. So it's running right now. It's on startnext.de/stickybiscuits. You'll find it there. I think we're on 70% now, so it's only like 30% missing of what we need. It's anyone who wants to support us there, that's very welcome.
Let's hear one more song, and everybody please do donate to Sticky Biscuits. Thanks. And help them make their album be good, genuinely, yeah, good people.
If that link was too short that I said before, you can follow us at Sticky Biscuits on Twitter, and we are on Facebook.com.
And so this last song I wrote some time back when I was house sitting for a friend of mine, because she was, I think, in Barcelona. And she said, you know, make yourself at home. So after I had emptied her bar, I did what we all do at the end of the night after half a bottle of Jägermeister and the rest of the peppermint schnapps. I Googled my ex. And I got over 33 million hits. Because it turns out the rat bastard has one of the most common names there is. So it ticked me off a bit, and I wrote a song about it. And this goes out for any one of you who has ever dated an Adam Smith. It's called Ungoogleable You.
Yeah?
Yeah. At first it hurt when I found you were common as dirt. I thought you were one of a kind, only to find you were one in a million of you. Please don't let it be true. How am I supposed to keep an eye on you? Ungoogleable you. Now that we're broken up, you seemed so irreplaceable, but turned out on MySpaceable. The search for your name came up with 6,487 of the same. You're a school kid in Alaska. You're a lawyer in Nebraska. You're a DJ of AM rock. You're a fanboy that I had to block. You're a Christian metal band. You're a vet with a prosthetic hand. A backup dancer for MC Hammer. You're an Nigerian email scammer. I couldn't find you anywhere. My heart was nearly broken when I friended what turned out to be a rabbi in Hoboken. Whatever can I do to find ungoogleable you? I, on the other hand, am unique. Google claims there's only one of me. Just type me in and you'll see. They say I'm very stalkable, desperately approachable. If you should ever feel the need, you'll easily find my Twitter feed.
140 character solo. Thank you.
I'm the one who set you loose, 'cause I could not agree to your terms of use. But what can I do?
Ah, sorry.
I still miss you.
Lust?
I know that we'll never meet outside on the street. Wonderful, ungoogleable you.
Thank you, Biscuits, everybody. Mark and Naomi, thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
And while we're doing our thank yous, that's our show. Thank you all very much. You've been a great and generous audience. But yeah, let me just say thanks again to Sholem Kristalka. Check out his Berlin Diaries. It's on Hazlitt. Imogen Heath, check out Now, MomentNow.com. Of course, the beautiful Sticky Biscuits. Go and give them some cash. I've got a hat here of yours full of loose change. You're going to be very excited. And, of course, our fantastic Husband, Alex and Dirk's hilarious productions. They're going to play us out with one more tune. And I want to say, of course, thanks to Altes Finanzamt.
We're just going to play some musical things. We're going to go and have a fag and a beer. Wherever.
Yeah, this is a long one.